Thank you. I just want to tell Randy that he's telling us that he's had an experience here this weekend. I just want to tell him that we've had one, too. And I don't think ours is the same. You're a beautiful bunch of diseased people. And I'm delighted to see this study of 40,000 people show up here on Sunday morning to hear the Pope of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody asked how I got to be Pope. My sponsor said I was self-appointed. I'm glad I sobered up while I'm still living. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gotten to know me. And I've been sober ever since I can remember. Yeah, y'all are pretty sharp. And I was born at a very young age. And as far as I can find out, I was born sober. And I didn't have a bit of trouble with alcohol for the first 16 years. And then I was out with some friends that were a little older than I, and I had a slip. And it lasted for 29 years. So, I know what it is to slip. I love that slipping. I caught on to that real quick. I liked the hugging and the kissing and the rubbing up against in here, but I didn't like that no drinking. And it took me a long time to get the hang of that no drinking. But since I have, in Texas, and I live close to Texas, and I go to Texas a lot, in Texas they give the sobriety date. And they give it for two reasons. One, they say if you don't give your sobriety date, chances are you don't have one. And secondly, they do it because they want the new people to know how long this thing waits. Now, I've been sober since October 15th, 56. That's 34 years. Now, the only reason that I give my sobriety date it's because I'm bragging. My mother died with over 92 years of continuous sobriety. And she never mentioned it. Nobody ever cooked her birthday cake. So evidently I am bragging. I didn't sleep much last night. There was something going on down my way. I don't know what it was. But some young gal about 17, 18 years old, middle-aged blonde, she got to screaming and beating on the door. And I couldn't get her to hush. And finally I had to get up and let her out. You know, there's a lot of difference in Alcoholics Anonymous today and what it was when I came in. We're confronted with a lot of things that could destroy, in my opinion, Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill says if we are ever destroyed, it'll be from within. And I think we're in that process now. I can't control what people are doing in treatment centers. And I don't interfere with it. But when they get out, and if they come to my group, I can control it. So I think we are blaming treatment centers and everything else. But we also, need to blame myself. I think it is my duty as a sponsor to straighten out that new person when he comes. What this thing will do and what it won't do. And if I haven't worked the steps, and not into this thing, I think it's the duty of the group to straighten it out. and I belong to a small group in Olive Branch, Mississippi. There's a gal here from Memphis, or used to live in Memphis, Lou and her husband Richard. They know where Olive Branch is. It's a big metropolis of about 1,500 people. We've got one caution light. But it's a good little town. And everybody there knows I'm an alcoholic. I've talked in schools, I've talked in churches, and I have people to flag me down on the highway, ladies, and they say, "We understand that you're the president of AA." I said, yeah, that's right. "Will you go to see my son, or will you go to see my husband?" And I go. Now, I know there's some people in AA that won't go unless the person that's suffering answers. But Bill didn't ask Ebby. Nobody asked me. I was forced into this thing. This is a suggested program, and a judge suggested that I go. And that's the reason that I went. So maybe it gives me a little different slant on things by coming in the way that I did. Well, that takes care of the spiritual side of the program. We'll get into the business at hand. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Franklin Williams. By the grace of God, the fellowship of men and women like you, and because this program works, it hadn't been necessary for me to take a drink today, and for this I'm most grateful. I have a good friend named Tom that lives in Louisiana. And he was at a convention not long ago, and everybody that got up, chairman, speakers, and all. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm an alcoholic and chemically dependent. So when he got up to speak, he said, "My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic and a circumcised male." Somebody asked him what was the significance of that. He said, "Not a darn thing." But you people are getting up and you got a dual problem. So I thought maybe you had to have a dual problem. So it is about as senseless to say that it is to say I'm an addict. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It even says so on the outside of the front page. And don't you forget that it is my duty, and it's your duty, according to the big book, if you read the black part, to carry the message to the sick alcoholic. It don't say anything about carrying it to the diabetic or the fellow with hemorrhoids. Carry it to the alcoholic. And that's what I try to do, and that's what every member in our little Olive Branch group does. My wife Eloise passed away about 5 years ago, and she switched over from Al-Anon to AA. And she says the Olive Branch groups are the best groups in the world. And said, if you don't believe that, don't go somewhere else and louse up that group. Stay where you are, sit on the front row, help clean up, and become a part of your group. The text of my sermon this morning will be to keep it simple and follow directions. That is and always has been hard for me to do. I don't keep anything simple, and I can louse up a one-car funeral. I just don't follow instructions. Now, to let you know what progress I have made in those areas and what progress I am making, I have to bring in my sponsor. Lou knows my sponsor, David Gates. I call his last name because he's gone on to the big meeting. But David was one whale of a AA. He's the most honorary little sucker I ever saw in my life. And I say this, if you have a sponsor and after 60 days you like him, you got the wrong sponsor. I got to talk to an alcoholic at the level of his or her understanding. And David talked to me at the level of my understanding. Profanity. I could understand that. He could get my attention that way. So, I think if there's a weakness in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's in sponsorship. It's certainly true in the places that I am familiar with. You people coming in, you don't know what sponsorship is. I see in my area young people come in, and one fellow come in a week before another one does, and invariably one of them will be a gal and one of them will be a boy. One of them gets drunk and the other one gets drunk. And they call themselves being sponsors. That ain't got a thing in the world to do with it. I'll try to tell you what I think sponsorship is. So I have to bring in David. And David, for a good while, took me to a meeting every night. And he finally said, you'll have to get there the best way you can. We find out that if you carry a person too long, he gets dependent on you. And this is a program whereby you don't get dependent on a human being, but on the God of your understanding. So I'll meet you at such and such a group tomorrow night. I said, David, you know I don't have any wheels. I don't have money for a streetcar. I don't have no way to get there. He had a little old smirk. He looked, he'd twist those lips around, close one eye, and say, we find walking helps. So I had to go because he was the only person that'd take up any time with me. I told him, I said, David, if I was like you people, if I had somebody to sponsor me in a little business where I could get on my feet, I too could stay sober. And if I had a wife, like all y'all have a wife, I too could stay sober. And if I had decent clothes, decent rags, I too could stay sober. I read the David for 5 years out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous before I found out he could read. He knew where everything was, and he'd turn to the right page, and he'd point and say, read me this. And I read him that book for 5.5 years and explained it to him. And sometimes I'd have to explain it 4 and 5 times. He was slow to catch on. But the poor little fellow was trying to stay sober. And as intellectual as I was, well, I felt it my duty to try to help this little fellow stay sober. And I tried for 5.5 years. And it was quite a shock to find out that David really could read. And you know, I tell you how slow I am. When Eloise came across from Al-Anon into AA, she had me to read and explain to her. She said I was so successful with David that I'd help. I could help her. I said, yeah, if I had these things, I too could stay sober. He turned to page 72, I believe it was, and had me to read. No, on page 98. I read, wife or no wife, job or no job, our sobriety does not depend on others, but in our willingness to trust God and help others. Then he pointed over on the right-hand side, page 99, said, read this. Then he flipped the page to page 100 and said, read this. And then he said, what does it say? I said, David, it says the same thing. He said, I know it. He said, Bill figured some cat like you was going to come along and you'd miss it on page 98. But you're bound to get it on 99 or 100. And he's always talking about getting a sponsor. You know, I got a sponsor in a very peculiar way. I don't know whether anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous did. But my wife left me, and she turned me into y'all. And the person she turned me into was a judge. And the judge called Marion Hill. He's gone on to the big meeting. Lou knew you, Marion. And Marion invited David. And Jerry, man's wife was there. So the three of them began to tell me what Alcoholics Anonymous could do and what Alcoholics Anonymous would not do. And I was beginning to think it was a poor risk to join up because there wasn't much of the things that I wanted that they had anything to do with. They didn't loan money. And I just didn't see where I could better myself in it. But since the judge had suggested that I go, I couldn't afford not to go. So I tried to go along with them. And it was rough. They called me over there and they explained these things to me. And then they said, none of us wanted you. Said, we had seen your picture in the paper, we had read about you, and none of us wanted you. So we decided to draw straws. And said, I drew straws and I lost them. And said, I'm your sponsor. I said, what is a sponsor? He said, I don't have time to explain it to you. But you'll be at the meeting tomorrow night and every night thereafter, and we'll explain it to you. And you'll experience it. Well, I didn't like that way of doing. I said, now I haven't even been to a meeting. I hadn't paid any dues. How come you're my sponsor? He said, everybody's got to have a sponsor. At that time, I was going to Quonset Group. He said, everybody in the Quonset Group has a sponsor and says, you're going to have one. So I did, like it or not like it. So David took me, as I said, to many meetings. He took me out one night and he said, when we stopped, he said, now this is a closed meeting. Well, I didn't know what a closed meeting was, but I sure wasn't going to ask David. And I said, are you going to talk? I said, you've talked at every meeting I've been to for the last 2 weeks. Don't anybody else talk? He said, nobody you need to hear. So I said, am I going to talk at this? He had said he was going to talk. He said, if they don't run out of time, they may call on you. Well, I beamed. Because as I told you earlier, I had this keen alcoholic mind. And I had read your book, and I had come to the conclusion that we modern-day drunks coming in wasn't as bad as y'all. Our brains hadn't been destroyed, and we had a little more going for us. So I had cut out 7 of the steps. And I had a 5-step program, and I was going to write a new book, The Modern Day Alcoholic. And I thought these people ought to know about it. So I got out of the car and slammed the door and started on toward the entrance. He said, wait a minute. Come back in and sit down. I came back and he said, I want to give you some directions. He's good on giving them directions. He said, if they do call on you, you get on your feet. He believed when you said something, get on your feet. You get on your feet and tell them you're an alcoholic, your name is Franklin Williams, and you're a member of the Quonset Group, and sit your behind down. Said, you done told them people all you know. I said, yeah, but. He said, oh, no. He said, your best thinking got you where you are today. And we'll do your thinking for a year. And if at the end of a year we think you can think, we'll tell you you can think. But don't you dare think before then because it may break your mind and you'd never be the same. He said, another thing, I want you to get something simple that you can understand. He said, surrender is the most important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that. So I immediately thought about this friend of mine named Red McGinnis. Red McGinnis was from Sullivan's Hollow. You don't know where Sullivan's Hollow is, but it's a section of Mississippi where a clan of Sullivans live. And they don't pay any attention to the federal, state, or any kind of laws. They got their own laws. Many revenue men have been in there and none have ever returned. They'll take a revenue man and fly him all day, and then give him a bale of hay and, and 8 ears of corn and say anything needs a good meal before he dies. They're tough. So I said something smart to Red McGinnis. The people in the little old store started laughing, and I turned around to laugh with them. And the next thing I knew, I was trying to get up off the floor. And every time I tried to get up, Red knocked me back down. And I believe had there not been some compassionate people there, old Red McGinnis would have killed me. Well, this was over 50 years ago. And if Red McGinnis had come in that door this morning, I'd go out one of these over here. I completely, unconditionally surrendered to Red McGinnis. Now, that tells me what a surrender is. You're going to have to find out what a surrender is to you. But I certainly didn't have any success with this program until I had a Red McGinnis surrender to alcohol. And David taught me to talk to myself. I had to meet him down at the group there an hour before the meeting. And we were together at least an hour after the meeting. So we talked about surrender. And he had me, first time he did this, he said, "Franklin, I want you to go over in the corner and get out on your knees and count yourself." I said, "Are you crazy?" He said, "Oh, no." So I went and I came back. He said, "How many did you come up with?" I said, "One." He said, "That's right." I said, "You're improving." He said, "But remember this, you are one. You're one child of God. You're one member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You've got one chair in your group, and be there and use it." And that meant something to me. And many times now, I'll go over in the corner and count myself and have a Red McGinnis surrender to alcohol. Then a little bit later, I had to have a Red McGinnis surrender to God. And not until I did these two things did I really have any success in this program. So I do believe that surrender is the most important. I've never seen anybody get sober and stay sober unless they had a surrender to alcohol. Why did I come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? I've already told you, this is a suggested program, and a judge suggested that I come. And that's the reason that I came. I was afraid not to go because he gave me a choice of going to the penal farm or going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I later went to the penal farm. I had to go the whole route. So they picked me up. I'd gone along for a good long while. I'd go to one meeting a week, enough to let my ex-wife know that I was going, enough to let the judge know that I was going, enough to let people that I was trying to con out of some money know I was going. And, you know, it is hard work. I don't know how many of you have tried it. But to drink 6 days a week and sober up to go to a meeting on Monday night. And, you know, a lot of times I couldn't make it. And my sponsor would look me up. And he always knew where to find me. Be the first place he went. But he'd get me, ride me around, and we'd talk. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is, was, and always will be one drunk talking to another drunk. That's where I got most of my AA. You know, getting back to this oneness of purpose, I'm really hipped on that. And I really believe that you and I are falling down in our obligation, and I think it is an obligation, to the new member coming in, to get him straightened out on how he should get up there and introduce himself and what he should talk about. You know, General Service sent out maybe a year ago, maybe a little longer than that, I've forgotten, but a little blue piece of paper with on one side what to do at a closed meeting and what to do at an open meeting. And it tells us very plainly that if you have the dual problem, don't get up there and talk about your experiences taking this other stuff. We are Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to always remember that. I can sum up this whole program with six words. And a matter of simplicity, and this may not suit you, but find you something simple that you can understand and rely on it. Use it. Trust God, clean house, and help others. Now, I can tell you where I get this out of the big book, but it's not necessary that I tell you. You've got a big book, and you can find it. And you can find you something, if that don't explain what it is, something else in the big book will. Now, I say these six words every morning when I get up, many times during the day. I spend a lot of time, I have some physical problems, and I spend a lot of times in a recliner. Whether I have to or not, I don't know, but I spend that time there because I'm more comfortable. And I'll tell you about my meditation when I get to that step and the part that just trust God, clean house, and help others do it. I went to AA hopefully once a week, but a lot of weeks, as I told you, I didn't make it. For nine months. And during this time, I was slipping. I ran across a fellow in my group named Bob, and he was good at slipping. And I'd never heard that term, having a slip. But Bob invited me out to his car after a meeting on Monday night and taught me how to slip. And it was real easy. And I loved that slipping. I wanted to go out there before the meeting because I could talk better after I slipped. But Bob wouldn't let me slip until after the meeting was over. So I did this for a period of 9 months. And then I got so sick and I hurt so badly that I really started to go into AA on a sincere basis. And I went along for a period of approximately 9.5 years. Going to a lot of meetings, working the steps, I thought, to the best of my ability. And I still insist that I worked it to the best of my ability, but I didn't have much ability. What it boiled down to, I didn't have the honesty. Now, when I talk about honesty in this program, I'm talking about void of self-deception. I was a past master at deceiving people, but mainly myself. And I had a rough time with this. Character defects, I never completely get rid of character defects. They return. And they return for one reason and one reason only. Because ego returns. Ego returns for one reason and one reason only. Because self-deceit returns. As I say, I was a past master at deceiving not only others, but particularly deceiving myself. So I went along for this period of 9.5 years, and all of a sudden I became restless and irritable and discontented. Things which Dr. Silkworth stresses in his part of the big book, or which is really not a part of the big book. It's in there before the AA program starts. But I had a lot of problems in this area and still have problems in these areas. I contend that nobody can ever get to be 100% honest. If I could, I'd get to be as big as God. But I don't know of anybody else other than me that's been that smart. You can see I got a problem with ego. So David had me to come to meetings an hour early and had me to stay at least an hour after the meeting. He had a little old car out there, and We'd get in that car and sit, and sometimes we'd ride, sometimes we'd go, and he'd buy me a hamburger or buy me a malted milk or something. We used to meet in places there in Memphis after meetings, shoot the bull, and really enjoy fellowship. So I got on to the meeting there early that night, and I was really on a low limb. David walked in, and I said, "Come here, David, before people get here. Let's get back here in the kitchen. I want to talk to you." So I got back there, and I unloaded on David. He said, "Yes, I know." He said, "I've been praying that you'd either come to me or somebody else in AA and spill this out before you got drunk. And God has answered my prayer. But most importantly, I told David things about me I had never told another human being. And David told me things that I don't think he had ever told me. He told me a lot that I didn't pay any attention to. So if he said it a second time, I really didn't remember that he had ever told me. But we opened up to each other. And I think that's what a sponsor is supposed to do. Nowhere in the big book do I find that it tells me in taking a fifth step that I take my fifth step with him or her. Well, I've never had a gal take the fifth step with me. I don't sponsor gals. I'm scared of them. I can't think like a gal. When Eloise was living, Eloise went with me, and she talked to the gal, and I talked to the prospective Eleanor. So David told me, "Let's get down on our knees." He believed when you prayed, he said said he couldn't tell me that I was an alcoholic, but he could tell me I was a real alcoholic. And real alcoholics get on their knees. He said, "Let's get on our knees back here and ask God to help us." And so I did. But first I told him, I said, "David, you know, I've told you before, I don't believe in prayer. I'm an agnostic." He said, "Don't make a darn whether you're agnostic or not. What you got to make up your mind is whether you want to be a drunk agnostic or a sober agnostic." I said, "I don't know how to pray." He said, "I'll pray, and I'll say a sentence at a time, and you repeat it after me. And this will do." I had heard Tom from Louisiana, said that the two most important things about prayer was first start doing it, and secondly keep on doing it. So David had heard that, and David told me this, and says you do something. Nowhere in the big book does it say that you came here believing. You come to believe. You come to believe by doing the things that are suggested in the 12 steps. So I came to recognize this, and I finally got to where I really did believe and really did mean it when I was praying. But about all that I could say was, "God help me." And I was told that that's as beautiful a prayer as a sick alcoholic can offer. And you don't even have to believe it to begin with. So I did this. And David said, "You missed the boat somewhere." He said, "I gave you a yellow legal pad to write your inventory on and explain to you how to do it." And said, "Several months later, I kept asking you and you hadn't finished it. So I gave you a deadline. And we went out and I asked you to let me see your inventory." And said, "You had lied. And you had taken a fifth step, but you took it with a professional man. And the reason you did, because you could lie to him, you couldn't lie to me." And said, you didn't take the fourth step according to the way that I told you, according to the way that I pointed out to you in the big book. You wrote a life history. He said, "I want to tell you this." And he tore up that inventory. He said, "I want to tell you this. Writing a life history for a four-step inventory is worse than taking no inventory at all." Why? Because Dill says that the purpose of a four-step inventory is to find causes and conditions. What caused me to do this and what is the result thereof? And if you write a life history, you're not going to find out what caused. So he said the reason that it's dangerous is because it brings to light these deeds that happened a long time ago. And the more of them that are brought to light, the more guilt there is. It don't do anything toward identifying what the real problem is. So how did I find out what the real problem is? He had, first we'll go back a little further. We went out on the lake. He loved to go out where the water was. We sat on the same log out there every week. And we'd spend a day. We didn't just ride out there for a joyride. We rode out there to get some of this A&A, I called it. And he had a lot of it. And he explained it, a lot of it to me. And you know, after approximately 9.5 years of going to Alcoholics Anonymous on a part-time basis, see, I was an associate member. For a while. If they had an eating meeting, I was there. But that's the only way I was eating for a long time. And I'll always have a tender spot in my heart for the Al-Anon. We had a noon meeting in Memphis. And the ladies would bring sandwiches. And they got to where they put some sandwiches in a sack and called me off to the side. And say, I was living at the YMCA, not the YWCA, but the YMCA, just a block from the old club. And I'd go home when the club closed, and they said, you're going to go home and you'll be hungry, and you can eat these sandwiches. Well, I lived on those sandwiches for months and months and months, and the Al-Anons were so kind to me. And I got to where I really, really loved them. Now, this was before the last wife that I had. She never did. She didn't have a drinking problem, and she didn't go to either Al-Anon or to AA. And she left them. I figured she'd come back. You know, she'd left a lot of times. She'd gone home to her mother. And I just accepted that. She's just that way. She's going to go home occasionally, but she'd always come back. So I figured she's going to come back. And this was over 30 years ago. And you know she hadn't come back yet. So I finally decided that she wasn't coming back. So in the meantime, I had a light housekeeper. Sound like maybe some of you did. At least you know what I'm talking about. But I met another gal in AA, and I married her. And she's the one that, after maybe 10 years, she switched over from AA to Al-Anon. She became what you Al-Anons called a double winner. She was a heck of an Al-Anon and a heck of a AA also. So we made a lot of 12-step calls together. We went to a lot of conferences together. She spoke quite a bit. She spoke as a double winner. She was a heck of a gal. So I'd been going along there for about 9.5 years. I don't know exactly how long it was. And it said I got restless and irritable and discontented, and I knew that eventually I was going to take that drink, and I didn't want to drink. So I got on there early and opened up all this to old David. He said, we'll go out on the lake Saturday. This is on Monday. But says, I want you to do something between 9 and 10. I want you to study and re-study and re-study the doctor's opinion. Says the most important piece of information that we have. and said Dr. Bob would have never accepted this deal had it not been for the doctor's opinion. A medical doctor telling another medical doctor what his problem was. And really, this little Dr. Silkway didn't originate part of the things that he told. Some of it came from Dr. Carl Jung, the old psychiatrist. And had he stood the chance of losing his esteem with his profession by coming out with calling this thing a disease, a twofold illness, an illness of the mind and the illness of the body. And he said that anything that leaves out either one of these doesn't have a real solution for it. So he said, after you study and restudy, see, David did something with me that I had never heard of anybody else doing. But he gave me assignments and had me to study them. And then he'd give me an exam. And if I didn't understand it the way that the book had it down, he made me do it again. So I got to where I knew that I was going to eventually have to do it to the best of my ability. And I tried. And I'd go to David and ask him questions. I know when I first started asking him questions, I wanted to appear to be, know something about the thing and to be interested in learning something. And I'd ask David, I don't understand that serenity prayer. He said, what part of it don't you understand? I said, the first part. But I don't understand the second part. I don't understand the third part. He just said, I said, David, if I'm bothering you, I'll hush. He said, oh, no. I said, how are you going to learn something unless you ask questions? He wasn't telling me a damn thing, but I was talking about it. And he says, then after you do this, he said, study, restudy the first four chapters. And said, do you know why I want you to do this? I said, no, I don't. He said, nowhere in any AA literature, big book, 12-12, or any brochure, does it explain how you take the first two steps. You don't take the first two steps. You become convinced of it. Now, he did this. He'd make me read something, and he told me later the reason he did it, because if I read it, and I'd go to some other group and hear something there, I'd know whether it came from the big book or not. So I knew. I really believe there's more bad stuff floating around AA than there is good stuff. At least there's too much bad stuff. You don't have to write it in, Tori. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do that. I used to tell David, I said, old Allen told me there ain't no must in this program. So finally he said, I'm going to get you straight. You can do what you want to about Allen. But he said the word must is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous 74 times. So don't come up here with that jazz about the book don't say there's a must. But says here's one must that's not in the big book, but you need to know it. He said, rarely have I seen a person stay sober who continues to drink. I said, where'd you get that, David? He said, oh, I figured it out. Said, rarely have I seen a person stay sober who continues to drink. You must not drink any of that stuff. You must not swallow it. See, I learned things a simple way and a hard way. Getting back to Al-Anon, Eloise really got to be a wheel of a Al-Anon. And I was with her on a lot of, see, it's a small town we lived in, and we'd go together. So I saw, and I saw what the Al-Anon was doing. And I loved what you had done for me. And I tried to show my appreciation for it. So my hat is off to you, Al-Anon. Now, unless you get too smuggly, you remember we drunks got you where you are today. And don't you forget it. So after I'd passed the test of having studied the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters, he said, nowhere does it explain how to take the first two steps. You don't take them. Read me the first few words in the paragraph after where we read the 12 steps and the next paragraph there. And it says, being convinced, you are at step three. So you don't take the second, the first two steps. You become convinced of it. That's the way it has happened with me, and that's the way it was explained to me. So that got me down to step three. And he had me to read what to do in step three. And the first thing it says it, in my book, the black part, it says that the root of my problem, my trouble, is selfishness and self-centeredness. And I have found that to be true. Every character defect that I have, everything that's wrong with me, everything that causes me any trouble, reverts back to selfishness and self-centeredness. And I can recognize this. So I didn't know that Bill suggested that we take the third step with another human being. Neither did I know that Bill suggested a prayer. See, there's a lot more praying in this deal than I realized. And I had to be taught this. And I had to become a little bit more honest, a little bit void of self-deception in order to see this. So David had me to take the third step with him. And then he said, now I want you to read the third step prayer and to offer it in your own words. I'd like to hear it, and I think God would too. So he had me to kneel down there by that log, and this is about what I said, and it's about what I say today. God, I offer myself to thee to do and build with me as I will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those that I might help in thy love, thy service, and thy way of life. May I always do thy will. David said, we're all right up to now. Now we are ready for step four. I hear people say they don't know when to take a certain step. They don't read the black part in the book. It tells you, now you're ready for such and such a step. Now you're ready for such and such a step. It tells you in there. All you got to do is be able to read. And if you can read, you know what step to take. So he had me to read to find out what I needed to do in step four. And he said I needed to to list all of my resentments. I needed to list my fears. And I needed to list the sex. And it gives me a format on page 65 of how to do this. Now, had Bill intended for me to write a life history, he wouldn't have put this part in there. He could have saved several pages of the big book. So I don't believe that Bill intended that we write a life history as a four-step inventory. So David said, you take resentments. And he had me to read it as the number one enemy. That it kills a lot of alcoholics, and I've seen it happen. So he had me to read resentments. I resent Mr. Brown. Why? Because his attentions to my wife. What effect does it have on me? It affects my sex. It affects my emotional security, and it affects my companionship. He said, now let's stop here and go to the 12 and 12. And read in the first paragraph of the 12 and 12 on step 4 in your 12 and 12. And it will give you the three God-given instincts, which I think are the greatest help in taking a fourth step of anything that I know of. An instinct for sex. An instinct for emotional and material security. And an instinct for companionship. He had me to read that Bill says that we ask for more, we try to eat more, we try to get more of everything than we deserve and can handle. And this is what happened to us. He enlisted my resentments. He said, put them all down before you put anything about the causes and the effects. And after I put them all down, well, I put on what the cause of this was and what the effect was. Then I listed my fears. I listed the people that I harmed. And step 8, it says you made a list of the people that you harmed in step 4. So I did this in step 4. I even put on the 7 cardinal sins. Now, they're not in the 12, in the big book, they're in the 12 and 12. And I put them down because I didn't want to miss anything. I wanted to stay sober. David didn't tell me to put the 7 cardinal sins, but he seemed to like it that I did do it. So it took me a long time to take a complete full step. But I took one which I thought was thorough, and it was for the time. I have taken many 12 inventories since then. And I hear people say, some people say, that you make one fourth step inventory and you throw it away, you're through with it. They don't read the same book I read. On page 51 of the old 12 and 12, it says the taking of a fourth step inventory is but the beginning of a lifetime process. And that's the way it has been with me. I don't believe anybody can come in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care how smart they are or how dumb they are. The dumber they are, the better chance they got. They don't have as much to unlearn. I don't believe that anybody can go to a treatment center for 28 days and write a complete, honest fourth step. Impossible. With me, as I say, I've been without a drink for 34 years. I need a sponsor today worse than I needed 34 years ago because I have more to lose. And things are coming to my conscious mind that happened back years and years ago that I had buried and had forgotten. So I've got to do something about that. I've got to take a new fourth step. If I take a new fourth step, I've got to take a new fifth step. David said, do you know why you need to take a fourth step? I said, I know what the book says. He said, the book don't say this, but this is what it reads. You need to take the fourth one so you can take the fifth. He said, there ain't no way to take the fifth step without taking the fourth step. And you know he was right about it? And he showed me on page 72, he had me to read, that the taking of a four-step inventory is but the beginning of a lifetime process. It says those who fail to take this vital step do not relieve their alcoholism. Invariably, they drink again because they hadn't learned enough of honesty, humility, and fearlessness by telling it all. And David said when something's in italics, it's important. And all is in italics. By telling it all to another human being. That's a grave responsibility, in my opinion, of the person who is sponsoring somebody, to be able to take those steps with him. And David spoon-fed me on these steps. And we did a pretty good job. As I say, I've taken many more 12 steps, four-step inventories. And I always get some relief and some reliefs. So Bill says we never get enough of anything. What is that but trying to satisfy a human ego? We've got a boy at home that loves to fish, he loves to drink, he loves to do them both at the same time. And fall or two ago, he was going out to go fishing. Little ponds were frozen over. He went to the place that he'd been buying minnows all year. He asked him how much were his minnows. He said, all you want for a dollar and a half. The old drunk didn't bat an eye. He said, give me $3 worth. Ain't no way to satisfy a human ego. I found out that my real problem, was ego. And until I could make some progress in getting rid of some ego, I wasn't going to have much peace of mind and serenity. I'm a pig about this program. I want all of it that I can get. And there's plenty more that can be gotten from this thing. I'm thoroughly convinced of it. David took a dictionary around with him, as well as the 12 and 12, and as well as the big book. And he had me to look up words. He had me to look up believe. One of the definitions is to rely. I am coming to rely on the forgiveness of God for yesterday, the grace of God for tomorrow, and that only leaves me today. And there's nothing, I mean nothing, that can come up in my life that can't be handled if I'll turn it over to God. David turned to a page in the book and had me to read that the problem at hand is never greater than the power behind. The problem at hand is never greater than the power behind. I have another way of putting this. There's no end to where I can go in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'll never run out of God. I'll never run out of God. And that is a comforting thought to me. So I took that fifth step. We had the book open. He had me to read what to do. He says, now you go home and get in a quiet place and thank God that you know him better. Not that you know him, but that you know him better. See, I will never get to where I know God, because if I do, I'll be as big as God. I mean, I've given up on that. I don't believe I'll ever get to be that good. You know, a lot of people, me included, come to this program and want to get good before we get well. And I darn near got drunk trying to get well before I got, trying to get good before I got well. And I'm still working on trying to get well. Maybe I'm doing something toward getting a little good. I'm gooder than I used to be. I used to use a lot of profanity from up here. David stopped me from that. And he says, any program as beautiful as Alcoholics Anonymous that starts off with a prayer and ends with a prayer, there's no room in the middle for vulgarity. So, now I know all those words. And I'll use them out there with you. But you won't hear me get up here and use them from up here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous too much to do that. And I love me also. I want to get everything that I can out of this program. Then David had me to read, turn to page 6 to 7. And there are two steps explained there, and it don't take much room to explain them. One of them was character defects, and the other was to ask God to remove them. I had to pray for willingness. See, some more praying in this deal. I had to pray for willingness to want to get rid of these character defects. And then when I decided that I really wanted to, I had to get on my knees and ask God to remove them. Now, this may be controversial. I don't know, but it works for me this way. I haven't gotten rid of my character defects. Or I have for a few hours, a few days, but they always return, as I told you, because of my ego returns. They always return. Now, I know that God can do anything. But I think that God wants me to do certain things that I can do for myself. So the things that I do for myself in regard to my character defects, is that God affords me the opportunity to practice the opposite of that. For instance, there's no way that I can be suffering from self-pity if I'm practicing gratitude, and so on with the other defects. If I practice the opposite of it, well, then I think God intervened. Now, this is just the way I think it happens with me. I don't know how it happens with you. So after we took the seventh step, he said, let's take this seventh step prayer, and he had me to read that. Then he said me to take it out loud, said that he thought again that God, he and God both wanted to hear it. So it goes about like this: my Creator, I am now willing that you take all of me, the good and the bad. Remove every single defect of character which stands in my way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. May I always do thy bidding. David said, we're through with that part of it. Said, you got to continue to pray. See, I have to go back to the third step and repeat part of that prayer every day and sometimes many times a day. I have to pray for removal of self-deceit. And that's the job with me. I don't know how it is with you. Then continue to take a personal inventory. I think the key to that is to continue. I know what the book says, that at the end of each day, review the happenings. And if we've done something that's detrimental, to do something about it. But I don't do that always. Pain is the thing that makes me do it. I get to hurting badly enough, I'll do anything. And pain is the thing that's motivated me to do what I have done and am doing. And I thank God for that step. The Bill says that the step that separates the boys from the girls is number 6. And I really believe that. And I have to do continuously. I have to work on that. Then to make amends. It says you listened to people you harmed in step 4, which I did. Some more prayer. Pray for a willingness to make amends. I had one man that I swore I'd never make amends to because he had hurt me. I thought he owed me amends worse than I owed him. But David said, you don't look at it that way. You're doing this for yourself, not for Andy. So he let me have his car to drive that 75 miles to see that man. We met and got out of the car, and both of us started crying. We embraced each other and told each other that we loved him. He was an old-time member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He died a few years ago and was a very, very close friend of mine. Making amends to Andy probably saved me from getting on a real drunk. And I thank God for a little old sponsor that stayed on my neck and stayed on my case and made sure that I did what the book said according to the way that the book said. Continue to take a personal inventory. I do this. Not as I should do it always, because I don't do it at the end of each day. If it's something big, well, I do. But usually I've got to hurt some before I do it. Prayer and meditation. Evidently, somebody else besides me has had a problem. Because I went to David one day and I said, David, I just cannot meditate. That I sit down or I get on my knees or whatever. I meditate a little while and then my mind jumps way off over here. He said, why don't you get you a 12-12? I said, I got one, David. He said, why don't you use it? And he turned to the explanation of the step on that prayer and meditation and had me to read. And Bill says to pick out some good prayer, some prayer that you think is a good prayer, and try to picture where that person is as opposed to your prayer and where you are. And the prayer that was suggested is the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, the most beautiful prayer that I ever heard. So I got to where I could say a part of that and meditate on it. I could say, trust God, clean house, and help others. And I got to where I could really meditate. And it was brought about by doing it, by doing it. And I learned to meditate. And now meditation is a much more important part of my life than prayer. This don't mean that I don't sometimes ask for things. I do, but maybe it's all right if I accept no for an answer, or wait, or whatever. But I do concentrate more on meditation. And I'm thankful for David and Bill and others for having this in our literature, because it's been very, very helpful to me. Having had a spiritual awakening, well, he had me to look up, as I told you, the word believe. And one of the definitions was to rely. And I told you I'm coming to rely on the forgiveness of God for yesterday and the grace of God for tomorrow. I think that the greatest force in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is prayer and love. I think love is the apex that all men of the cloth are trying to get across to us. And I have been around you people long enough to see and experience the miraculous healing power of love. The people in the little old Quonset group in Memphis, Tennessee prayed this little old drunk sober. And there's no other way that I can explain it. So David told me, in the beginning, I told him I didn't believe in this praying business. He said, nobody says you have to believe it. Just start doing it and keep on doing it. So I'd been doing it for a long time. And I told him to begin with that I didn't like that praying business because it's too churchy. But I finally got to where I would pray, and I really meant that prayer. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, what is my duty, my obligation, is to tote the message. What is the message? In step 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That's my message, and that's the only message I have to carry. I don't have any message to carry you about what to do about your sex problem, your financial problem, your political problem. No, I don't. In taking the steps, I found out that there's no way that somebody that hadn't taken the fourth step, how he or she is going to explain this step to me. You can't no more teach what you ain't learned than you can come back from where you ain't been. I've got to have a working knowledge of this step before I am qualified to carry the message to an alcoholic. Remember, this is a terminal illness, and I can kill that old drunk by giving him or her the wrong information. So I try to be equipped when I go to make a 12-step call. And I always pray before I go. Now, here's a fellow that never prayed, and now he can't go to the bathroom without praying. But it works. And don't fix something that works. There's a boy, a black boy in Little Rock, Arkansas, that explains this thing better than anybody I ever heard. I wish I'd thought of it, but I didn't. And I can't take credit for it because Joe might find it out and he might get drunk. And I don't want to get him drunk, so I'll give Joe credit for it.
He said the greatest carrier of a message was a cat named Paul Revere. Said he rode through the countryside yelling, "The British are coming, the British are coming." Not one time did he stop that horse and get on and say, "Now, if I was you, I'd do this about your master problem. I'd do this about that problem. I'd do this about that problem." No, he carried one simple message. Now, Joe didn't say this. I said this. When he carried the message took care of itself. Them cats knew to haul ass. So it is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The message will take care of itself. And it's the only message that I have to carry, and it's the only message that I am qualified to carry. But I like to believe that I am qualified to carry that message. The message of a spiritual awakening as a result of the first 11 steps. I'll close the same way I always close, with my football story. It's not much of a story, but I just like the way I tell it. And I like to hear it, and I hadn't heard it today. So if you'll bear with me, I'll tell myself this story. I just like to think that the God of my understanding is saying unto me this afternoon, "Franklin, I'm getting up a football team. I'm going to make you the quarterback. I'm going to give you three men in the backfield that you were introduced to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the backfield, I'm going to give you hope, faith, and charity. Now, I'm giving them back to you in a reverse order in which you lost them. Got seven powerful men that you were introduced to in the program. At the two ends, you have honesty and humility. At the two tackles, patience and tolerance. And at the two guards, unselfishness and gratitude. And at center, willingness. Now, it's necessary that you use willingness on every play. This game is going to last a lifetime, and there'll be no timeouts. And I am not only your coach and your manager, but I am the sole official. And any decision I make shall be final. So I'm going to have to give you some ground rules. The ground rules are the Ten Commandments. The first four of these have to do with your relationship with your manager and your coach and the official. And the last six have to do with your relationship with your teammates. Now, the ball is your eternal soul and the goalpost of the gates of heaven. Now, get in there and play ball. I love each and every one of you. And I love God because it's my manager, God, that directed me to you people. And it was you people that explained to me what a God of understanding could be and was. So if you don't believe that this program will work, just keep it simple and follow directions. And if you don't believe that God will help you, just ask. Thank you, and God bless you, and I love you.